Welcome to a very special 30-second mini-episode of the FDH Lounge, celebrating 500 hours of programming with legendary Journey frontman and superstar solo artist Steve Perry.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late-night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Steve, welcome to the FDH Lounge, sir. It's a pleasure to have you in. How are you today?
Good. Could you speak a little louder? I can barely hear you.
Yes, sir. Yes, no problem. It's a pleasure to have you on the program, Steve. I know you've got so many great things that are happening right now with the vinyl remastering of Journey Greatest Hits 1, with the Greatest Hits 2 coming out, the remastering of Street Talk. What a very exciting time it must be for you. How did these projects happen to come about right now on the calendar? What led to the release of these projects right now?
Well, you know, Sony has, for the longest period of time, I think unbeknownst to a lot of people, they've been calling me from time to time, and I think the last one before this was a complete remastering and re-release of the whole catalog, and then before that, there was an essential package that was done. So Sony called me again and asked if I would oversee the remastering to vinyl, which is really exciting, because vinyl, in my opinion, especially on 180-gram vinyl, it sounds amazing sonically. And so I was very excited to see all these tracks returned to the medium that they originally were mixed for. You know, I mean, these songs, when we would go into the studio, we would literally know where the destination, meaning the last destination, which was vinyl, was. And so when you recorded those back in the day, you'd record on tape, and then you'd run them through certain console enhancements, and then you'd master them. But everything was geared towards sonically and from a fidelity standpoint to make it sound the best it could once someone dropped a needle on a piece of vinyl. So there's certain things that means characteristically, meaning you gotta make allowances along the way and change things, because vinyl is very specific to what it can tolerate and what it can't. In other words, there's certain distortion things that can happen with sibilants, S and Ts, that the cutting head, when you cut the lacquer to make vinyl, will not tolerate. So these were, I would say, limitations back in the day, but with Pro Tools now and all the stuff that we can do from a digital standpoint, we don't have to sacrifice the overall sound of it. We can really do some things in Pro Tools and fix the little problematic areas by themselves and really have a better sounding record than ever. And I think that's what just happened with the new release of the Greatest Hits on vinyl, and also now the new release of Greatest Hits 2 and Street Talk 2. My solo album was also just recut to vinyl too, the first one I ever did.
Absolutely, and Steve, it's very interesting, because I think this would be counterintuitive to a lot of people in terms of what you just said there, because we tend to think of the digital tools, most of us anyways, as being sort of separate and distinct from that, but the notion of taking these instruments and reapplying them to the vinyl process, I'll bet there's a lot of people who probably wouldn't even fully appreciate until you just said that, just how possible that is and how much better you can make the vinyl.
Well, the thing about digital was when it showed up, everybody was so pleased, because all of a sudden there's no more dragging a piece of vinyl with a needle, you know, and no grit. And everybody went, oh, listen how quiet it is. And digital was much more able to take more level. So everything got louder, and digital could take more high frequency and more low frequency, so everything got bigger. But the problem with digital that every musician who's in the music business knew about, but nobody in the music business would listen to us, was that there is a certain harshness to high frequency sound when it's digitally reproduced, because you have converters trying to keep up the best they can with analog to digital conversion of music that was originally recorded on tape, you know. So the high end can be a little harsh, as we used to say, if you're not careful. So it's not means that it's a bad sounding CD. It just means the high end is not as user friendly as the high end is on record, because that whole medium of listening to music on vinyl is it's hard to explain it. It's more like this. It's not necessarily better or worse. It just feels good. Vinyl is something I just want to keep turning up, and digital I don't need to turn up too much. But the vinyl, I just want to rock it louder and louder and keep turning it up, and it never hurts me. It just makes me feel better and better.
Well, and I'm curious to know also how you feel in terms of the emotions of it. This is how a lot of people, of course, experience this the first time around. Do you feel like it's a way of renewing an emotional connection with the audience, since this is how so many people caught it the first time around?
Well, to be perfectly honest with you, I renewed a connection with myself.
Okay.
I forgot how great these tracks sounded until I started going through all these tracks again. And until I had to, like, convert them through beautiful tube amps, because the cutting head on a lathe that cuts a acetate lacquer with a cutting head, that particular medium is such an amazing lost art that the only way to really make it work and is to go through its electronics. And its electronics on this old cutting head is the most beautiful tube amps you've ever seen. And they're just so harmonically friendly to the music, because it's just like some kind of, for lack of a better term, it just feels like the music is being embraced somehow. So going through the medium like that and then listening to it come off the acetate cutting was like rediscovering how good the band really was. And I mean, I really forgot how hard we worked together and how hard we worked for the mixes to be great and the arrangements and the performances. And, you know, this, you've got to remember that the greatest hits and the greatest hits too spans about 20 years worth of music there. And so in 78, back in those days, there was not a computer to be found.
Right.
So if you threw cheeseburgers out in that tracking room, you'd get cheeseburgers on a piece of 2-inch tape.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever you recorded out there is what you got. So everything you're hearing was performed by people with their heart and their experience and their talent at the time it was recorded. There was no shortcuts. There was no auto-tuners for voices. There was no nothing like that. So it was absolutely record it, try to capture the best performance possible, and then overdub it and sing on it and mix it. So there's a lot of different things that went along those stages, including different recording consoles like Neve consoles. Some of them recorded on SSL. Some recorded on Trident consoles. And so every time you'd change a studio, there'd be a different console with a different situation. So they all sonically had their own different stamp on them. That being said, there was also a challenge when it came time for me to master them, that they all have a similar sound, a similar volume, and then sequence them so that they, you know. I must tell you, I thought a lot about what John Kane and Neil Sean used to say when we were in this phase together. I brought them into me so much because I was listening to them so hard every day, that it was a reintroduction to what they contributed so much to the music and everything. And I started remembering things that John would say and Neil would say about sequencing. And I tried to bring that into my consciousness so I could really, really, as if they were there, sequence the record.
Well, this is a wonderful look behind the curtain, Steve. No question. I want to ask you about some of the newer things you're working on as well here, but I've got to ask you a follow-up on that as well, because the Greatest Hits 1, Greatest Hits 2, these projects here, that era of Journey, if you will, I mean, that's the one that we all think of. These are the songs that all pop into our minds, and it's obligatory for me to ask you, as I've done when we've had Jimmy Jameson on previously or John Oates, what do you hear when you're driving in the car and you hear some of your tunes come on, or you're flipping around on TV and you hear it? Did it long ago cease being kind of a surreal thing to you, or how does it feel just knowing that at any given point in time you could turn something on and hear some of your songs?
Well, first of all, I'm I I I'm lost for words that even still happens, because in my heart of hearts, I never knew that this music would have as much of a timeless quality that we were all reaching for. We really tried to write and record timeless music. And for us, that was reaching for the best performance, the best songwriting, the best sonics we could at the time. But I don't think anyone, if I can speak for the rest of the band members and myself, I don't think none of us realized that we would be so fortunate to still see that happening, where you can turn the radio on today. I just feel so fortunate that that's happening. But how I hear them now is totally different than the way I used to hear them, because for working on them for years and performing them with the band for years, I heard them a certain way. But now that I've been out of the band since 98 and we haven't recorded a record since God knows when then, I'm able to now almost hear them as fans hear them, and I'm kind of surprised what I'm hearing. You know, it's like, I think I'm hearing them for the first time, to be honest with you.
It's really amazing material, no question about that. And of course, we talked about also in there Street Talk with the vinyl remastering of that as well, and that leads to some other talk here too in terms of your solo material. I've read that you've got some other things that you're working on here, and I'm curious as to the shape of it and the way that it might end up going. And I realize that it's probably a work still in progress as far as the direction, but I'm wondering if it's something that's likely to be very, very familiar to fans of the Street Talk era, or I think I read another description where you described it as potentially being more contemporary. Is it kind of a mix? What does it look like in your mind, if indeed there is kind of a direction yet for the next solo project?
I think the direction is that it is kind of a mix, because I never calculate any writing direction.
Before we get started and hear where we left off, I just want to thank you again, Steve. I feel like this is a very fitting thing here. We've been celebrating 500 hours of our show the last couple of weeks, and we had on UFC legend Ken Shamrock and then Bob Barker before that. So I really feel like we put together a murderer's row, and it's just a tremendous
I love that.
For us to do this. Yeah, that's who you're packaged in with, Steve.
Wow, so that's fantastic.
Well, I thank you so much. Yeah, this is just a great privilege. Where we were at, I know we were talking about the solo stuff that you're looking at and what's coming up, and as far as whether or not it was going to be a little bit more contemporary, a little bit more along the lines of Street Talk, or some kind of mix, actually.
Well, what happened was about 3 years ago, I loaded up my Pro Tool rig and just started giving myself the opportunity to dabble again, to put my toe in the water creatively, because I had let it go completely. I mean, Rick, I really had to let it go back in 98 when we broke up for the second time, which is what bands do, you know, and that's no big deal. That's what bands do. And so I just walked away from it and stayed away and let everybody do their thing, and I just disappeared. So I had to truly let it all go, meaning my desire to write music or be in the music business or anything. So about 3 years ago, after listening to certain groups that I like right now, getting me excited about music again, I just loaded up a rig and started writing some ideas and sketching. And what came out was a bit of a hodgepodge of everything direction-wise that I could come up with. I didn't stifle myself, meaning I didn't say, well, I have to stay within something that sounds like Journey or sounds like the solo, or, you know, I didn't get into any of that. So I got into some stuff that doesn't sound like any of it, and then some of it does sound like that. So that's what happened. And so I've got this song sitting in there, and I've got quite a few of them. And now, as I've said in a few other interviews, the only problem I really have is going to be me, because of my desire to be good enough and to not suck too bad, you know, is always present. You know, it's always present. And I don't want to try to compete with or compare myself to anything I've done, but it is lurking in the wings, and I don't want to have to live up to that either, because I just want to do where I'm at right now.
Well, along those lines, and one of the things that makes it, again, a real privilege to get to talk to you here is that, again, as you well know, there's been this mystique that's built up since you stepped away, since you took some time off and kind of went into the background. So I think people would be very curious to hear Steve Perry, in his own words, your thoughts on the present state of your health, how it affects you or doesn't affect you, anything from the arthritis to hip replacement to anything about the voice. Do you feel like the voice is back at prime level? Anything that the people would be interested in knowing about the status of you physically and how that affects your music going forward?
Well, I think first of all would be the emotional status, that I truly had to let go of music and just fall back into my life without it, to and try to be happy in the world, in my life, without this incredible ride that I once had. You know, some people hold on to it ad nauseum, you know, and I just think that it's, sometimes it's time to leave the dance, as my grandmother said. You know, my grandma used to say, you don't want to be the last one to leave the dance. There's a time to dance and there's a time to leave, you know? And so, so I think emotionally is part of it. I've gotten to a point where emotionally I'm okay, but do I miss performing? Oh God, I miss it. Do I miss the audience? I miss the audience terribly, because they brought a certain vocal performance out of me that I can't get without them. They wanted me to sing certain things. I could feel it. And so I would try to go get it for them. And so if that's not a symbiotic relationship, I don't know what it is. It's just, it was an amazing interchange of emotions, being on a stage in front of an audience and finding that voice. So that being said, I would say that my voice is as good as it once was, exception for the range, and that would probably take a good 2 to 3 months to get that up of rehearsal, live rehearsals, because there's two kinds of singing. There's a studio singing, which is one kind of singing with microphones that are so sensitive that they can hear a smack of the lips or a breathe or anything. There's that kind of singing. You could call amplified singing. And then there's the kind of singing that requires you to dig in with blistering levels all around you for live. And that's like sitting down at a bench press right now and try to press 200. You're not going to do it if you haven't done it for a long time. You're going to tear yourself up. So vocally live would be the challenge, to go back and spend a couple of months rehearsing and building the voice up muscularly at that level. Physically, I would say that physically I certainly am an arthritis kind of guy. I'm not sure if it was genetics or rock and roll or both, but they certainly have worked together and left me. They certainly have worked together and left me with arthritic changes in my body that cause physical pain. Anti-inflammatories are my friend, put it that way, okay? Nothing else, just anti-inflammatories. And so that's where that's at. And I have had my hip replacement, and there have been a couple of other orthopedic-oriented pain relief surgeries that I've gone through in the past years that have been fairly successful. And so, you know, that's what happens when you live through the arc of rock and roll. You get on the other side of it, and I think I've discovered that rock wasn't all pretty, but somebody had to do it. You know, I mean, it looked pretty, but it left a little bit of a bruise. You know.
Well, any of us who ever watched anything on Journey Escape can probably guess where some of the arthritis might have come in here. You guys
yeah.
really did live a lifestyle back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
But,
yeah.
The part about anti-inflammatories being your friend, I must say, that might be the one takeaway that makes you the most approachable to your public, because that is the case for a great many of us, most certainly. It's interesting to know that. Steve Perry is not immune from that, just like the rest of us. There's a lesson
oh,
for people.
No, sir. Oh, no, sir. It depends if it's raining or not, Rick. You know, that's what we're talking about, Rick. And that tells you everything you need to know.
I think so. Yeah. And the rain clouds that can bring their own form of pain. You were mentioning about voices specifically. I'm thinking from something that I'd read about you, and this caught my eye because myself and my mom were big fans of Sam Cooke also, and I understand that's something you got from your mom, and I understand that Sam Cooke was a great influence on your voice and how you went ahead with your career and how you approached singing.
So true. I remember being in my mother's Thunderbird, a little tiny Thunderbird that she owned, and we were driving around, and I just remember hearing this song coming off the dashboard, because back then radios had one speaker and they were in the center of the dash, and I just remember hearing this voice come across, and it was it was Sam Cooke, and he was singing Cupid, and the way he sang "Draw Back Your Bow," I just couldn't believe this guy. It's just tunnel vision kicked in on that speaker, and the whole world went away, and I was captivated in the echo, in his voice, in the music, in the track behind his voice, and the way the track sounded, and then the way the track felt, the rhythms of it, and the soul this man had in his voice just absolutely slayed me, and I was motivated, highly motivated at that point to find out, be it ever so tiny, what part of that I could ever feel or try to become, to try to experience any of it if I could. And so he truly pushed me and challenged me to reach for some emotion and soul that I wanted in my voice.
That's tremendous. I mean, for an artist who has cut short himself like that, what a great part of his legacy then to have inspired you. And that's something, and I know that you've spoken of Steve Cooke, Sam Cooke. I know you've spoken of him previously, Steve. So that's got to be something as well. That's got to feel really,
but
really
great
put
on
to be able to pay tribute.
But Rick, you got to put on that list the track "Troubled Man" by Marvin Gaye.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah,
that kills me to this day. That track slays me to this day. I mean, it really does. "Sexual Healing" absolutely slays me to this day. These are tracks that are forever timeless. They're just timeless. That's why we keep hearing them, because I had the privilege to meet Levi Stubbs years before he passed away. And as you know, Levi Stubbs was the lead singer of the Four Tops, and I was a huge Four Tops fan. And he had told me that music was timeless, he said. He talked like that. He sounded just like the voice he did on Little Shop of the Horrors. That's him doing the monster voice. And he plays the plant on that Rick Moranis film. So when you see that and you hear him go, "Feed me, Seymour," you know, he's doing that whole thing. That's how he really talked. And he says, "Oh, music is timeless." I said, "Really? What do you mean?" He said, "Because people hear it the first time they heard it, every time they hear it." And I just could not believe how true that was. He just gave me that, and I walked away with that. And I think he was so right, you know. He was so right. If it's in the grooves and it's done right, which all the Four Tops stuff was, of course, and Marvin and Sam, then it's forever.
Well, the great music makes people react that way, definitely, and we covered a little bit before the way that people react to some of the greatest music of Journey, and that takes me to one thing I wanted to talk about with you as well here. I know your intersections that you've had with the world of baseball. I know in 2005 with the White Sox taking "Don't Stop Believin'" and making it an anthem, and of course your team from your area, the San Francisco Giants, winning the World Series last year. I mean, those had to be some great moments for you, spaced out 5 years apart there. But one with a team that sought you out and adopted you, and another one for a team that's so beloved in its area and had waited so long to win a World Series. So we were reminded again a couple weeks ago just of the kind of joy that a town can have with the World Series. And Bob Barker was talking about that with us, about being a big Cardinals fan. And it just strikes me you've been able to experience that twice in the last couple of years.
I have. The White Sox was the first time, you know, that happened. They got a hold of me and wanted me to come out because they had just clinched the series. I mean, they just clinched the World Series to perform it, to play in it. And they had used, unbeknownst to me, they had used Don't Stop Believin' as their clubhouse song, and they were playing it before the games, they were playing it after the games, and they noticed that they started winning. And so Brzezinski got a hold of me through channels, and Creedy also got a hold of me, and they wanted me to come out to Chicago for the first two games of the White Sox 05 World Series. And I went out there, and it was just the thrill of my life, you know, to be sitting there and then go around the clubhouse with a team and before and after the games. And then the funniest thing happened was after that, he'd won two of those, both of those home games, and now we're going to Houston to play the next three games. I'm back there, and Rowan is icing, Creedy is icing, and we're sitting around, and Creedy says, "So you're coming to Houston?" I said, I got to go back. I just got through mixing in 5-1, the Houston 5 DVD live journey DVD. And I really got to go back because I'm starting some press. And he looked at me and says, you got to go to Houston. And I went, oh, that's sweet, man. Thanks, man. But you know, I've got commitments, and I don't have flights, and I don't have tickets. And he looked at me and said, flights and tickets will not be a problem. And I went, oh, that's right. You know, I didn't realize I was talking to the team. You know. So the next thing I know, I'm in Houston. And, of course, they won all three games in Houston, and that was amazing. And I got to go down to the clubhouse with them. And then the Giants, same thing. And it was just, you know, San Francisco Giants, I lost my voice for 2 weeks because I screamed so loud. I mean, toured. I had toured and sang, but singing and screaming is different. You know, when you're screaming, you're not singing, you know. So if you sing right, you know, you can get away with a lot more. But if you're screaming, you're going down. And so I was screaming at the game, and I lost my voice for 2 weeks. I'm not kidding you. It was not pretty.
Thank you. A great honor on our part. This is wonderful material, Steve. Thank you. God bless.
Okay, Rick. Take care.